Welcome to the hopefully not annual episode of this podcast, Bites. We're discussing Stephen King's Salem's Lot on this episode, and I'm Joffrey Spurl at Joffrey Spurl on Twitter. JoffreySpurl.com is a website. I've got other stuff too, but I won't bother getting into that here. Michael.
I'm Michael Gordon. I'm technically Ben Gorham on Twitter and a lot of other places, but have not really done anything. So you will not have seen me anywhere. Yep, that's it.
I'm Alice Wolfadell, aka Fred. I'm Alice Dragon on Twitter, and hello.
I'm Matty Tucker, I'm Doomed Rider on Twitter, and MattyTucker.com. There we are, that's me.
Here we go. Before we go too deep, what did you guys think of the casting announcements for Sandman?
Oh, yes.
I might have made really inappropriate noises, just for the record.
I'm living under a rock, I think.
No, I mean, I'm very interested. I heard about it initially just because Jenna Coleman playing Joanna Constantine.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks interesting, and I'm waiting to hear the rest of them. Stephen Fry is an interesting choice, possibly an obvious one, but...
Yeah. I mean, he looks like Gilbert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stephen Fry is always a good choice for anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd cast Stephen Fry as Death, but, you know.
But it would be interesting.
It would be.
It would be a creative decision.
So now I like them. I think they look good.
Yeah, they do.
I'm not. What was that?
I don't know. I'm gonna watch it. I might just cry, you know.
So it's still a ways off, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm interested. It's Netflix, so that could swing it either way in terms of its quality.
Right.
The sort of people who are saying, oh god, it's going to be another comic book ruined, are the wrong sorts of people, so that doesn't put me off watching it. Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm very much looking forward to it. So,
yeah.
Even more so than I was American Gods. Good Omens, I thought, went very well.
Yes.
Yeah. That was delightful.
Yeah. So I'm hoping it hews a little more closely to Good Omens in terms of faithfulness than American Gods.
I mean, it's that, are they going to embrace the sort of slightly, the very out in the world, sort of the humour, that kind of thing, or are they going to go for dark and gritty?
The thing is, there is enough Sandman to fuel an on-running series. There is enough American Gods for a series of something. It's when they said it's going to be two series that I realised I possibly didn't want to really engage with this, because where are you going to find that material? Whereas Sandman is, it's long.
75 issues, plus Dream Hunters, plus Overture, plus the two Death storylines. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It's
you can get 2-3 seasons out of that without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot that happens as well. It's not just there's a lot of comic.
Right.
There's a lot of plot.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he said they're filming Doll's House right now. So that should mean that the first season is Preludes and Nocturnes in Doll's House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they could stretch it to 4-5, assuming that it's popular enough for Netflix.
Dream Country and World's End, which don't really stand alone.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
I can also see them really compressing Prelude's Nocturnes.
Yes.
As in, you could easily get rid of a lot of that stuff just as a kind of... Because Gaiman was filing his feet there and stuff, and it's very Prelude-y, you know?
Right. Agreed.
Yeah. So. It's also very like DC Comics references that...
Yes, oh, exactly. Yeah.
Just doesn't fit as well with the later stuff, except I think in the wake, like Superman and Batman and others are show up at Dream's funeral.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But you could easily just cut that bit from the wake.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I mean, I really hope that they show Hector Hall in his yellow and red Sandman garb from the 60s and 70s. And in that regard, it would be nice to have that link back to the costumed DC characters, but I don't think it's necessary.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
All right. Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time since I've read this and rereading it. Was interesting. It's definitely it's from that really prolific King period of the mid 70s to like mid 80s, where he seemed to be publishing a new novel every month. Where even his publisher said too much. And that's when he started writing the Richard Bachman stuff. Right. I found that I definitely approached this differently. What now? 32, 33 years after first reading it. In that I was less interested in the vampire plotline than I was in the small town allegory. Mm-hmm. So that's where my mind kept going. I kept flipping back to how Barlow is emblematic of the decline of small town America. But
yeah.
What did you guys think?
I'm trying to remember how long ago I first read this. Probably between 15 and 20 years. And I don't remember being distinctly like, oh, can we just get to the vampire stuff? But I probably reacted that way. And this time I was really able to like get into all the different narratives going on in the town and, you know, still getting excited. It's like, all right, here comes the vampire stuff. But it's like when you said, like, it's his prolific period. It's like a lot of authors, when they're prolific, they're churning out a lot of stuff, but it's like this, like, it's a big fat book for, you know, for a horror novel, and it's just like it's just so full of characters and narrative. It's just it's a delight for the most part. I still can't stand the McDougal baby thing. I was just like, I'm gonna really skim this very fast because baby abuse, nope.
Yeah,
vampires are I'm just like,
vampires are cool, but baby abuse, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was also reading it, you know, several months ago and had, you know, she was, I guess, like 6 months old at the time. So I was like, no. Sure.
It puts a different perspective on it, doesn't it, when you've actually got one in the house?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you've got a vampire in the house,
hugely different perspective. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, I mean, I've always been of the opinion that every Stephen King novel I've read could stand to be one third the length it is. So I read it a year ago, so I might be a little rusty. I wasn't going to read it again. Let's see. Like, I found, yeah, the vampire aspect. I think he was trying to do two things. He was trying to do a fairly straight modernization of Dracula, which was quite an interesting project that he then sort of got bored with halfway through and sort of instead wrote an allegory of hatred and hatefulness in small town America, which I think he did quite well. And there were some lovely creepy bits that would have made really good short stories internally in that. But he's never done it for me. He just hasn't. So, yeah. And it was a year ago I read it. So, Matthew.
Okay, so yeah, it was the first time I'd read any Stephen King.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I wasn't sure what to expect. I think there were... I think the thing that really struck me was the amount of time he spent, what it seemed to me, convincing the reader that everyone in this town was hateful and we didn't really care if they all died. It was, you had this, you know, you would get a chapter and you would get, it's like, I think it was the first chapter that was really just a character, sort of a character piece for all the different townspeople. And the only likeable character in that was, is it Michael? The boy?
Mark?
Mark. Yeah. The one who deals with the bully. And there was a certain thing that was quite draining about reading, particularly those sections. And I was trying to work out to what extent these are just the characters. You weren't supposed to take any kind of view on them, or to what extent it was this, as I said, this sense in which you were supposed to feel that whatever horrific things were then going to come about as a result of it being a vampire novel, there almost a sense in which they had it coming, and certainly with certain characters, that was clearly the case.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who was beating his wife and then threatening the guy who his wife was cheating on with, absolutely. You were kind of cheering for him, cheering for the other guy when he turned into a vampire and then showed him what for. It was that kind of sense in which, I don't know, there was something quite unpleasant about aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the darkness of the heart of men stuff, isn't it?
Mm.
It is. And he really likes that. I mean, it's not... It's not... unique to this novel in any way.
No, I can...
I just wonder sometimes if you look around and you go, God, everyone in this room is an asshole. maybe...
Maybe you're the asshole.
Maybe you're projecting a little, you know?
Could be. He does that... I mean, I said the other day in our chat, I would say that between... this and The Shining and probably It, you get a really good sense of what his writing style is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bit of a template. He likes his ensemble casts with one or two characters really being the main leads. Yeah. And then he enjoys giving you 100 pages of exposition on everybody's background.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he likes to center it all on sort of a educated but flawed American who is also an American man who's also very masculine but sensitive.
Yes.
and often a disgraced teacher of some form or another. I don't know where I get that.
Or a writer.
Yeah.
So often. And there's, you know, got to be a precocious kid.
Yeah, naturally.
Yeah.
I haven't read any of his later stuff. Like, in the past 25 to 30 years. So I can't say if his style has changed, but yeah, it's very much I don't think I want to say template, but it's very
he has the elements that he likes, and
yeah,
he mixes them together in different ways, but there's a lot of familiar
His concerns as well. Like, to do him justice as a writer, those are his concerns.
Yes. Yeah.
They don't speak to me, I think, is probably my major complaint with him as a writer. I'm sure if they do, it's fascinating.
Because the amount of detail and exploration of this small town, the way that it was done, So if you think about someone like Fleming, the James Bond novels are a chance for people to explore the world and cuisine and stuff that people that living in the 50s really weren't able to do. It's a tourism thing. There is a sense that I got from this that this is a slumming tourism novel. It felt very much like we all want to experience, I might be wrong here, but it felt like this wasn't written for the sort of people who are living in small town America. This was written for people living in metropolitan America who wanted to feel what it was like to live in the small town America. There was a certain elitism to the way it was written.
Or possibly people who have left, and dear God, thank God I don't have to go back.
The similarity I got was with Vierce Naples' Miguel Street. Mm-hmm. So that novel, all written about, I think it's Trinidad. And you've got this, and again, that whole piece is a lot of sort of individual character pieces about the sort of people living in that particular street in Trinidad. And the whole thing is, that's where Nepal grew up, and he very much likes not being there anymore. And this, it was a kind of quite a sort of cynical sort of look about, that's the reason I escaped. And it was, there was something similar to how I felt about this in many ways. Mm. Observing the small town from the sidelines, and say slumming it tourism.
I can see that. Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, when you look at his background, he was all over, like, the Midwest and New England in the U.S. as a kid, just because his family had various issues, you know, keeping everything going. Mm. His father left when he was like 2, 3, something like that. And so his mom would move wherever she could get support at. So he's actually familiar with those small towns and some of the bigger ones too. I know he spent time in Chicago. I know he spent time in Portland, Maine. I don't know how large Portland actually is, but I assume it's relatively large. I think a lot of it is... It could be tourism. It could also be him trying to reconcile how mid-20th century America was kind of eating itself from the inside out. I don't know. I think it would be an interesting one to ask him to talk about now.
Yeah.
Hopefully he will, because the guys who worked on the It movies last year were announced to be doing a Salem's Lot adaptation. If we really need a third Salem's Lot adaptation, I don't know. But supposedly they're working on it. You know, the original miniseries I thought was well done. I had to look up how the second miniseries worked. And it's dreck.
It's a good cast.
The one with Rob Lowe?
Yeah, Rob Lowe's good. It had Donald Sutherland, I think, was he?
Might be. I haven't seen it. I just know that it starts with like a showdown between Ben Mears and Father Callahan in Detroit. I don't know why.
I vaguely recall this, yeah.
So, I haven't seen it, but it, spoiler alert, it's 16 or 17 years old. Spoiler alert, Ben dies at the end of the miniseries at peace, because Mark has managed to take out Father Callahan, who I think is actually a vampire in that. He's not just enthralled or something like that. So, yeah.
I don't think I ever saw the whole thing. It's a bit of it.
Yeah. I have fond memories of the original miniseries, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't really want to watch it again.
Fair.
There was a follow-up called Return to Salem's Lot that is really bad. Kind of think The Howling with vampires.
Okay.
So the vampires have basically established themselves in Salem's Lot. They have their little community, and a cultural anthropologist shows up. He grew up there, shows up, and they want him to write their story.
Interview with a lot of vampires.
Yeah.
Okay.
Vis-a-vis The Howling. If you haven't seen The Howling, it's a decent werewolf movie. Mm-hmm. A little dated, but yeah, decent.
Yeah. Yes, I was just thinking about sort of themes of consumption and rot, because I think the thing that really struck me about it was that, the sort of overlord of it aside, the vampires are mindless.
Mm-hmm.
They are not, they are sort of self-replicating empty vessels of vampirism. Mm-hmm. They maintain no personality. They're not quite zombie-ish to my mind. I think they sort of walk that line, but they are drone-ish.
Yeah.
And they collapse in on themselves. Yeah. Obviously, your metaphor for urban decay.
Yeah.
But the thought of putting that as a story where the vampires want to tell their own story, this is sort of a True Blood or something.
Oh, and you get into the whole, the anthropologist, of course, had a crush on, you know, this one girl in school. Mm. And he's coming back when he's like in his early mid-40s, and she hasn't aged a bit, right? So, you know, you get all of that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What fun.
Don't watch it.
It's
Isn't there not supposed to be a Salem's Lot to return to? Do they not set fire to things at the end? Is that...
They did.
They did.
It's not really described, but like...
They did. I don't
There's the postscript stories where basically the vamps sort of are still there in this ruined, burned out town, which I read as if it were part of the novel and only realized afterwards that it wasn't.
Oh, you're talking about One for the Road.
Yeah, that one.
Yes. That is officially the sequel.
Yeah. But it's in the edition appended right to the back of the novel.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can
just
read
sort of breeze on.
Yeah, it's a very Lovecraftian. Oh, yeah. There's this New England haunted village over there. No, nobody goes to. Yeah. And now we have to go save somebody whose car broke down in haunted New England village.
Honestly, yeah. I preferred it to the novel.
Oh, I could see that. Sure.
It works. I think it works as a story. And it's convincing, and it gets all the points of the novel across in a very slim space of wordage. I'm really pro it.
He's an excellent short story writer. If you haven't read Different Seasons, which has both The Body, which is where Stand By Me comes from, and Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, which is Shawshank Redemption. They're novellas, but they're very... Oh, an apt pupil is in there, too.
Oh.
The creepy...
Nazi
one. Yeah. I can't remember the fourth breathing method. Yeah, that one's weird, too. Woman gets hit by a car. Pregnant woman gets hit by a car, decapitated, and her body still... manages to go through labor.
Okay.
What happened in Blade? Isn't that what happens in Blade? Isn't that like his origin story? His mom got bit by a vampire and
he's dying similar.
And
then
gives birth to him.
She doesn't get decapitated.
And she's not like she's a vampire like later on, so
right.
It's unclear at what point she gave birth, I guess.
Yeah.
Very good part.
Yeah.
But he's an excellent short story writer. I don't like Jerusalem's Lot, which is the short story that is very... sets up a very Lovecraftian...
Yeah.
Like, there's a giant ancient god living underneath Salem's Lot.
That's in there, too. I gave
okay. The Centipede, it's the Centipede Press one. Is that it?
I didn't finish it.
No, is the edition the Centipede Press?
No, I don't think we've got them in there. Who's these guys? It's Hodder.
Oh. All right. Yeah, I'm not crazy about that one. That feels like a color by numbers Lovecraft story.
It started quite well, but that was my impression. He went to the evil church, and I was like, you know what? If I want Lovecraft, I just read Lovecraft.
Right. Yeah. And he loves Lovecraft. He'll admit it. He absolutely adores Lovecraft. But he's not Lovecraft. So I prefer that he deal with the horror of 20th century America than ancient gods.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say Fred had said that it could have been a third of what it was.
I mean, it could.
When it is sort of that case study of a once vibrant, what were they? Lumber mill. Lumber mill?
Yeah.
Milling town?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Of a once vibrant, rich milling town. You know, can you make it shorter?
I mean, I don't know that I could. It's not my novel. But yeah, sure. Hands of a competent editor. Yeah.
I just finished putting to bed a book that is probably 80,000 words at this point. No, it's less. It's probably 60. But the original manuscript was like 150.
Mm.
Yeah.
But it's considering that he tells essentially the same story in One for the Road.
Yes.
With such elegance and succinctness that you think, yeah, I reckon he could do it. He knows, you know, it is a dying stop on the road town within the first two chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How much more of that do you really need?
I mean, I suppose what I was thinking about this with this is, okay, so he's got a particular way that he wants to tell this story. And yes, he has these like four sections, which are just these character pieces and all this kind of thing. But it's, there are sections of Salem's Lot which feel just like, this is a short story. This is a short story that doesn't even need to be in here. This is, yeah, and it's in itself is absolutely fine. And I can see what he's doing with those, but absolutely, you don't need all of it. You don't need all that there. It's, if you compare to Dracula, you could easily have condensed what he was doing there with, let's say, a couple of news articles and this kind of thing. So you've got a sort of feel to the, have one extract from the sort of person there, have a news article about what's going on in the lot. That kind of, it was just this fact that he felt the need to, let's do this and this and this and this and this and this, so that you were overwhelmed by the drudge of the existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the, because the other part of that is the epidemic vampirism,
mm-hmm.
which we've not done a lot of actually in this book group. The idea that one bite and you're out.
Yeah.
You know, normally you have the ritualized turning.
Right.
But the sense of one, and then in Dracula, obviously, Dracula can kill and he can feed, and if he feeds, you turn.
Right.
But the feed will kill you very, very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
But this sense that, yeah, you get bitten once and then you turn and you rise the next night.
Yeah, very, very efficient.
It is.
Showing how quickly that spreads was one of the things I found quite well done.
Yeah.
But it's like he got carried away with that as a concept as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, the very quick spread struck me even when I was a teenager, because I just thought, why wouldn't this have just spread across New England like wildfire?
Well, I mean, explicitly, because if you look at the relative power of these vampires with the spread, then this explicitly could not exist, because mm-hmm. It was too powerful. It was too, it only works if you then just describe, start to see it as an analogy, as something about the decay of the individual town. I mean, if you really want to try to stretch the point, maybe it only spreads so easily because the decay is already there. There's something about the reason why whatever his name, the lead vampire, moves in to this town. Yes, exactly. Is because he thrives in that environment. He wouldn't have thrived in Detroit.
And it's also people won't leave, people can't leave, and then it sort of sinks in. Like, because you get the sense of epidemic vampirism there, that it sinks in into itself. That you have the town that's ripe for it, and the whole town falls, collapsing inwards. And then the vampires just sort of hang around mindlessly for the rest of eternity.
Yeah, it's like what's the long term plan here?
yeah. And specifically because Barlow was this ancient, very intelligent sort of. I mean, yes, absolutely. He cops it, and therefore, maybe he did have a plan.
Who knows?
You do feel that. Well, what is he doing? And I mean, the extent to his age and power, isn't he supposed to be thousands of years old? I'm sure at one point he describes predating Christianity.
Right. Wait. I don't have my copy. Where is my copy? It's downstairs.
Yeah, because when it was just that he is Dracula, it was like, okay, fine. But yeah. He sort of sets himself up as like Cain?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was interesting because the general thing that I was thinking is if you just look at the core plot, it is absolutely it is almost a straight adaptation of Dracula. It works quite well. There are certain bits where I thought this was. Straight out of writing a vampire novel 101. But it works. You've got the way they all come together. You've got them sort of going out on this fruitless quest against a power that's far greater than them. The way that they're all picked off works quite well. Even if you get to the point that actually it's working so well that you can't quite believe that Ben manages to win in the end. And of course, obviously, he doesn't really win in these until we talk about the burning of the town down, right. When he manages to kill Barlow and then runs away because he realizes he's overwhelmed. But it works quite well as a, if you just looked at quite a compressed sort of vampire novel, but I don't know. The discordance between that Dracula type novel, which if you ignore this sense in which he is some sort of ancient evil from the dawn of time, mm-hmm. which I'm is a speech where he starts talking about that.
I think you're right.
But then that discordance with the sort of the general sort of sense in which this is a epidemic that is spreading, and I don't know. I think it does feel like there's two separate things going on here, and I don't think they entirely mesh.
Yeah,
I can understand that. Yeah, I do know that he wrote it very much inspired by Dracula because he had been teaching Dracula. At the school, he was a teacher and had the idea of, oh, what about Dracula in the 1970s? And I think the Wikipedia article goes into this too. His wife was like, yeah, he'd probably get hit by a taxi cab in New York. And so she's the one who actually suggested the rural setting. She's the one who said small town.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I understand Tabitha has had a lot of influence, especially on his earlier stuff. There is very much a Dracula thread running through there. Despite all of that, he sold that book for over $500,000.
Wow.
And so there was clearly something that the publisher was like, oh yeah, here, buckets full of money. Because half a million in 1974 and 1975, adjusted for inflation, has to be...
I mean, not to shy away from the fact that it's still a
1.2 million, somewhere in there. What was that?
That's a shit ton of money now, Jarvis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, advances do not get that big unless you are...
It's not
a ready payment.
What was... Hold on. Inflation calculator. I'm curious now. If in 1975... $2.48 million.
Now that's quite a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm assuming Ben Myers didn't manage to sell his novel for that much.
I'm guessing not.
No.
I'm guessing his dreams of being a successful novelist were kind of scrapped after his walk down memory lane in Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more of that story.
Yeah. You can't always go home. What do we think about Susan?
I mean, understandably, I have feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got one female character in the entire novel. Is what, 15 years younger than him?
Ish, yeah.
You know I'm not a fan of Jonathan Harker. Everyone knows I'm not a fan of Jonathan Harker. But like, those two are more or less of an age, of a class. They're equals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you replace one of the most respected and empowered heroines of Gothic fiction. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot, but Mina is top tier.
Sure.
With some wide-eyed schoolgirl who you then kill off. I just...
And you kill
flames
off.
Side of my face, you know?
Wait, what was that, Maddie?
Flames side of my face.
You kill her off in... the purpose of her being killed off there in a narrative sense was... to demonstrate that this is a Scooby-Doo gang meddling powers far beyond their control. She was she was punished for her naivety.
Yeah. Definitely.
Which, I'm just saying, in 1897, Stoker, had it be the lads' club with their little terriers and all that, getting punished for their naivety. If you can't hit that standard of gender balance,
that's
part of 100 years later. I just feel you might be doing something wrong.
I mean,
yeah.
I did find a problem with the general machismo of the novel. It's very, very male.
Yes.
It's coming back to the point that we've made earlier on, but yeah, Ben Myers proves himself, yeah, it's that sort of, despite the fact he's a writer, he has to prove that he's a real man, because he's willing to have beer and barbecue like a real man.
Yes.
Not like European or artsy, just because he writes books.
And that's obviously contrasted with your very typical thing that you get in vampire novels is, what's his name in the antique shop? Not Barlow, but the other one. European striking looks and good manners, which
and homosexuality
and right. And all the women are all sort of, oh, he's all right, isn't he? And obviously proves to be evil. and yes, it's yes, yeah, so obviously. What's the name? Is it Sophie? Who's the girl?
Susan.
Susan?
Susan, thank you. Susan. Susan's mother is taken in by as opposed to really distrustful of Ben. Whereas you know, at least Ben and her father get on like house on fire and you know, so because they recognise a common. It's that there's that sort of real sense of this is. You know what I mean here. It was uncomfortable. There was that moment where, Susan says, from a woman's perspective, this was what's going on. And it was just cringeworthy.
Yes. I can agree with that.
It was very much about what he was like as a man. The sort of responses that a woman gets when a man talks to them like that.
I saw the miniseries before I read the book. Mm-hmm. And the miniseries treats Susan differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Susan's played by Bonnie Bedelia, who, if you don't know who that is, she was Bruce Willis's wife in the Die Hard movies.
Oh, Die Hard.
Yeah. And so the... Hold on, I'm just logging into something.
Don't they combine her father with Dr. Cody or something? I agree.
Oh, I can't remember that. Yeah. I just remember it being very striking that Ben and Mark aren't in Mexico in the miniseries. They're further south. They're in Guatemala. End of the miniseries has Ben coming into his bedroom and finding the vampiric Susan on his bed waiting for him.
Oh.
He still dispatches her. He leans in for a kiss and then stakes her. But that's pretty much the end of the miniseries. And I always found that a more interesting take on mm-hmm. Susan than how she's handled in the novel. I mean, she's not Mina by any stretch of the imagination in the miniseries, but she does seem to have a larger effect on the storyline.
Is the fact that in the book she is a love interest, she's not a protagonist.
Yeah, that's it.
And then she gets fridged, and it is a proper fridging.
Yeah.
It is, yes. It is definitely a fridging. I agree with that completely.
It gives Ben the motive to be a man.
Right.
And the thing I find really hard about the book, the thing I really struggled with reading it was, so I was reading it very early in the pandemic, and I've just obviously had surgery, and right. I've been surrounded with a lot of people showing me a lot of very unwarranted kindness. And I'd really seen some of the best of humanity that year. And it was realizing that, at least in Salem's Lot, King doesn't write people, he writes caricatures.
Yes.
And the only people to whom he has any empathy, really, are sort of lower middle class men
mm-hmm.
who are good at school, who, you know, are relatively educated without being in the slightest bit effeminate, and everybody else was a caricature of something or other. And I found it really almost upsetting, I guess. Like, I don't mind a bit of nihilism in my work, in stuff I read, you know, I don't, mm-hmm. it doesn't bother me, but it was just the sense that nobody got any real possibility for growth or change or redemption unless they fit a very narrow definition of humanity. So the tragedy is the boy, because I cannot remember any names because this was a year ago. So Mark.
Mark.
Boy,
Mark's parents were human.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, Dr. Cody, was human.
Mm-hmm.
That was about it.
Yeah, I can agree with
Everybody
that.
Else was a caricature.
I can agree with that.
Other than obviously Ben as the main character.
And Matt? The teacher?
Yeah, Matt. Yeah, Matt was okay.
Yeah,
but he was then...
He given a heart attack and, you know, confined to the hospital.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't manly enough.
Now... Yeah, have any of you... Well, okay, I know Maddie has it, but have Fred or Michael, have you read The Shining?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I've read The Shining.
So The Shining is the next book after Salem's Lot. So you go from cast of dozens down to the three, the three main characters plus the the caretaker, the older guy. What is his name? I can't remember. Played by Scatman Carruthers in the movie. But The Shining, of course, I'd argue that Jack in The Shining is very much the sort of machismo, toxic, masculine sort of character that Ben Mears is trying to be in Salem's Lot, all to his detriment.
See, I would argue that he is exactly the same character.
Yeah.
They are exactly the same person. It's because and also are given the same fucking patience and interiority and space. It's just that you see him from a much more sort of self-loathing perspective. They're the same person. I saw no difference between them. It's just one of them gets to be the hero.
That's fair. I think that would be a good paper.
Yeah. I suspect someone's already written it.
I mean, they're very much... The two novels are kind of very much two sides of the same coin in a lot of ways. I'm kind of disappointed that I didn't reread The Shining.
I mean, again, it could stand to be about a third the length.
Yeah. Yes. I find... What was that?
I preferred The Shining.
Yes, so do I. I think just in terms of modern Gothic literature, The Shining is a much better example.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think Salem's Lot is really a Gothic novel.
It's Hollywood Gothic.
Yeah, sure. But I would consider The Shining a Gothic novel.
Mm.
So.
I was thinking about trying to reread. I forget which book in the Dark Tower series has Father Callahan show up. It's like, this is what happened to me after Salem's Lot. It was really weird.
Is it?
I think it was like the fifth book. I don't know.
It's like The Wolves of Kala or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't read all of them.
Don't bother.
I think I love the Gunslinger. The
fix at a magic turtle statue or something. I don't know. It was a long time ago I read it.
I love the Gunslinger. And
yeah.
For the most part, I enjoyed... The second one was The Drawing of the Three, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that, I kept going because it seemed like there were these, big mysteries behind this world building and, waiting for some sort of payoff. And then the end, just like, why did I waste my time with this?
By the time you get to the end, you're just reaching the Stephen King cinematic universe.
True.
Because
I think he shows up as a character at one point.
it's pulling in everybody at that point. It's pulling in from the stand, and it's pulling in from, well, Eyes of the Dragon pulls in from the stand, but
yeah, he's got a character from Insomnia. Yeah, but yeah, it's very, it's too much Stephen King.
Yeah, I did enjoy The Gunslinger, but it's also like Fred was saying, it's like a third of his regular novel length.
It's short.
And though it took him like 12 years to write it.
And it was still too long.
But then, like, I think by the time he got to like book 4 or something in The Dark Tower, he's like, oh, I retconned all these things. I need to actually rewrite The Gunslinger. And I don't remember what was changed, but like they came out with a new version.
It's like, the director's cut.
You can't change your mind.
You've got to finish it first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I lost interest somewhere around The Wizard in Glass, I think.
Oh, those books are long.
How many are there?
So long.
What was that?
How many are there in the Dark Tower?
It's seven.
Eight?
Yeah. It's seven books, and then there's like short stories that like touch on it, and I don't know. There's
I like A Song of Ice and Fire, and that's too many books.
Yeah, I gave up on A Song of Ice and Fire. I made it maybe a quarter into the fourth book and just thought, fuck all of you. Let the dragons eat each and every one of you. I don't care. I still think a proper King's Landing police procedural with Ned Stark in the lead would be great. I'd be down for that.
Oh, I mean, to be fair, if you wrote to R. Martin and suggested that, I think I'm sure he's looking for an excuse to delay finishing the next book.
There we go. There we go. So in his spare time, before Ned's head was removed from the rest of his body, he got a 12-book series.
Yes!
Yeah, I can see that. King's Landing, CSI.
I'm like halfway through, the second book, third book? I can't remember which.
Clash of Kings is the second book.
Second book, yeah. And we've just finished... we've just finished what's his name Lannister on the TV series.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever his name,
Tywin.
Yeah, Tywin Lannister's just died.
Okay,
so that's.
Yeah, I don't know that I could read the second book again. It's quite intense.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Is that the one where the Red Wedding happens?
No, that's book 3.
Is that book 3? Yeah. Okay.
No.
I think. I don't know. It's been an age.
Well, it's not happened so far. Mate. I'm still in the, in Harrenhal Hall currently.
Okay.
But,
Nothing against Martin. I didn't like those characters. And I never made it past the first season of the show.
Really?
I tried. I just...
I didn't even try that, so...
I couldn't. So...
Salem's Lot.
We've talked about Sandman, and we've talked about Game of Thrones. Or A Song of Ice and Fire, however you want to.
I mean, I think... So, King sets out to write a Dracula set in small-town America.
Mm-hmm.
He probably manages it. It's quite clear what he's doing with vampirism, what he, you know, he's using it as a sign of decay and a lack of a moral heart.
And to which your own weaknesses open you, whatever those weaknesses are.
Right.
Yeah. It probably works, I think. I don't know if I'll ever want to reread it.
I'm quite glad he wrote it. I think it's an interesting take on vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hated it.
You sound like me with The House of Leaves. If you've never read that, that's a rough one. I can't remember the last name of the author. It's long. Long one. But House of Leaves is very Joycean, let's put it that way. More to Finnegan's Wake than Ulysses. So, yeah. Yeah, I know that feeling.
Interesting. So something I'd mentioned previously, and it unfortunately contrasts King in a poor light, but comparing Salem's Lot with Name of the Rose.
Well, I mean, you're not going to give him an easy time with this.
So,
I think he would tell you he's not going to compare. He is who said he is the literary equivalent of a Big Mac.
Yeah, and but so what you've got with Name of the Rose, the sort of echoes motive for writing it. I want to kill some monks, and in a similar sort of way to what King's doing here, you've got you've only really got one or two likable characters. Everyone else is, so they're really setting out to sort of show how essentially awful the Catholic Church was. That's what you've kind of got going. And you go around this sort of certain sense that that a lot of the people that meet their demise, they kind of deserved it. But the particular thing that struck me, the reason why I got this comparison, was the thing that Echo loves to do is to overwhelm you with description about something. So you will get the description of the murals and stuff in the chapel, and it will just be this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and it sort of absolutely fills you with this sense of awe.
Right.
And King does the same thing. He does this and this, this, so this rubbish character, this rubbish character, this, and you get overwhelmed by this sense of despair. And absolutely. I mean, Echo is sublimely good at what he's doing there, and it's not really fair to compare, but it's, there is a similar sense in what's going on there. Both of those characters are writing what they know and then adding a sort of kind of fantastic sort of murder mystery thing going on. I just found it struck me. It was particularly when I got, you had almost a cliffhanger at a certain point where you actually, finally, King's got on with the plot here. And you got something dramatic happening. And then your next section was a, 50 page montage of what's going on in the town. And it did kind of strike me that this was, that actually some of the pacing is quite similar to the way Echo does the pacing.
Sure.
So you don't care about your pacing, you're just going to listen to me.
Yes, you are going to, I've researched this and you're going to bloody well listen to me as I tell you everything about this whole town. Or, yeah.
I spent 20 hours in the library and you're now going to spend 20 hours with me. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he does it all over the place. I'm talking about King in his novels. He really does enjoy telling you about this character who really isn't integral to the plot, isn't integral to anything in the story, and you get 5 pages about how their dad beat them and their mom slept with their, you know, little brother, and, you know, then they found themselves working at a gas station after getting a PhD, and now look at them, right?
And now they're dead.
Now they're dead. Or about to be dead in the next page, yeah. So
I wonder whether in the sort of in the new world where we're starting to look at sort of much more sort of multimedia type things, mm-hmm. whether Stephen King would really benefit from writing stories, but when he gets to those bits, gets Tom Waits to just sing something? Because those sections would work perfectly sure. sung by Tom Waits.
It's very much a similar sort of attitude. I mean, the character that Tom Waits plays, because he is he admits very much that he is playing a character. Mm-hmm. The character that Tom Waits plays, called Tom Waits, is very much the same sort of mid-century American blue-collar searching for meaning Bukowski, you know, hanging over his shoulder sort of guy.
But I think Tom Waits admits a certain diversity of experience that you really want. Because you gave that list of what happened, and, like, I don't want to simplify, but that's literally what happened to every incidental character you meet. Their father beat them, their mother slept around.
Right.
They have suffered an enormous disappointment in education or aspiration.
Right.
They've now got a horrible job they hate, and they're dead.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's no real nuance there.
There is a reason why King says that he is a Big Mac, right? He's the literary equivalent of a Big Mac.
But, like, if the literary function of those characters is to make you realize that they're human beings with whom you have, like, empathy and support before they are cruelly cut off, to make his sort of spatterfest feel for you, and, like, you to relate to it, I just feel like looking a little outside your own box might really help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And to be like, yeah, you can have different sorts of lives, you know, that matter or don't matter, because obviously they don't, because he's going to get killed off in 33 seconds.
Right.
There's just, whereas Waits, he loves the bizarre, you know?
Yes.
He'll give you this sort of story of the one-armed, one-legged man who had been in a carnival and now, and then got a job as a dentist.
Right.
You know, like, you'll just kind of flow through the surreality of it.
Yeah, it's a different result.
Yeah, but it's also a different perspective. It's the ability to see beyond the end of one's own nose.
Yes.
I mean, I think in a sort of lewd. So I'm just thinking about all of the exposition in William Golding. Princess Bride, all of us, how Stephen King gets commissioned to write the sequel. And you've got this sort of whole sort of ludicrous fictional dialogue between Golding and King. And how King's just saying, yeah, it basically wasn't very good, mate. I think it's quite interesting, because in many ways everything that Golding does, there is that absolute contrast of what King's doing. The reason why he puts it there is that they're not comparable. They are doing something very, very fundamentally different, aren't they? Do you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you get those in backstories from an incidental character who's only going to be there for 2.5 minutes.
Yes.
And it is always about how they are a chess fetishist.
You see it in Douglas Adams, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, he spends how much time on the sperm whale?
Yeah.
Yes.
The bucket of begonias or petunias or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and it, I think... I think King refuses... Is he playful? I want to say King isn't playful.
He's King, not.
And that's where he contrasts with Waits, because when I start talking about Tom Waits, I think Tom Waits is coming from a very similar perspective to Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it that I do really like Waits? And I think it's that playfulness, that mm-hmm. that sense in which I don't know.
Well, it draws us to a perspective on vampires, because King's vampires become very hollow, self-repeating, and homogenous.
Yes.
Yeah, they revert to type. They revert to desire and lust and petty small world concerns.
Mm. Whereas, and I know neither Douglas Adams, to my knowledge, William Goldman, nor indeed Tom Waits have ever really written about vampires. But I don't think that's the direction they'd go.
I doubt it.
A novel by Tom Waits.
Has Tom Waits ever done anything with vampires? I don't.
Well, he's done Dragon.
It was
Beyond Renfield.
Yeah.
Beyond Renfield.
Yeah, I think that's totally...
King wanted to do Dracula but with a higher body count, and so he needed to, make some people to kill, and, wasn't much investment in making them likable.
But was there not? I much prefer to like people who are murdered callously in novels. It makes me
Which
feel
explains why you like A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yes, it does. I like nothing better to get desperately attached to a character and have them cruelly ripped away.
One of my favorite epic rap battles is J.R.R. Martin versus, George R.R. Martin versus J.R.R. Tolkien. Martin says, I make him love this character and then I kill him. And all the fans go, no, he didn't! Yeah. So, not running out to go see any of the Salem's Lot adaptations, I guess.
I mean, I can do. If it's for the podcast.
Although we didn't run out to go and do it, because we did actually say that we were going to watch the miniseries, I think, in the original pitch, which was a year ago.
Yeah, it was a year. We just needed to get back on to this. Again, I'd say it's probably worth watching the original miniseries. If you Rob Lowe, for the other one. Stay away from Return to Salem's Lot.
King writes in a very visual way.
Yes.
And I was reading it and quite often thinking, this would make a good film. Or this is clearly written to be turned into a film in some places. That is not a bit of prose. That is a stage direction.
Yeah,
I can see that. Yeah. I don't know if Had Carrie been made yet?
I mean, almost with the structure, the way you pan into the town.
Mm, yes.
Yeah. It feels like a film.
Yeah. And again, those sort of big bits of montage, would have been a bit of a montage of descriptions and stuff. It does. And so there was a part of me thinking, yes, I would almost prefer to be watching this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think Carrie was in production. Released in November of 1976. Salem's Lot was published in 1975. I don't think Carrie was in production yet. And I'm pretty sure that was his first... That was the first movie.
But you know how I said it was Hollywood Gothic?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is drawn from.
Yeah. It's absolutely written with the perspective of we will, you know, the audience will have watched a significant amount of at least Universal horror films and stuff.
Yes. Well, and Mark is a Hollywood monster fanatic. That's how he knows not to let vampires in.
Yeah. Mm.
Listen, it's so convenient they follow the Hollywood rules.
Yes, mm-hmm. Very much. So does Fright Night. So does this handle Hollywood rules better than Fright Night?
There's a question.
Mm.
Which Fright Night?
The original. Nothing against David Tennant and who played Dandridge in the remake.
That was
Arrow.
Oh, I can't remember.
I think Fright Night took itself less seriously.
Yes. I mean, if you have Vincent, God, now I'm forgetting their characters.
Peter Vincent.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mark is kind of like Charlie in Fright Night.
Yeah, absolutely.
Only Charlie's like 10 years older.
Yeah.
Yeah.
8.
And his main interest is getting laid.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I think it's quite interesting that considering the gritty realism of Salem's Lot, how you have got this kind of Scooby-Doo aspect. Aspect.
Scooby-Doo was a peer to this. I mean, it was relatively new at the time.
But considering you've got that, considering, you know, that how Susan is killed off, for example, and there's just sense in which the fact that he grants Mike supreme knowledge and understanding on how to survive on the basis of watching Hollywood films. And I know there are other examples, but the one I'm particularly thinking of off the top of my head is In Time's Fall. But where the whole conceit in that is Stephen knowing everything back to front about Dracula is yes, but I can't do this in real life. I can't. I just have fictional knowledge, and considering that would be an obvious route for King to go here.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched these movies. I know how to deal with vampires. Oh, it doesn't work that way. Damn, I'm dead.
But I think it's almost of its era in a way, because, you know, in Dracula, it's this idea that the supernatural can be mapped much as we have mapped all these continents, and it can be colonized much as we have colonized all these continents.
Mm.
In the 70s, it's like, we're all smart asses with no power. And this kind of enterprising Victorian spirit is just going to fail. And we're going to be lucky to get out with the skin of our teeth.
Yeah.
Most times for this very millennial and everything is rubbish and everyone has lied to us. But, you know, that's my depression talking.
Gen X doesn't disagree with you.
Yeah.
Now. Michael, does this fit your definition of a vampire novel?
I think it's pretty safe to say that it does. I don't even remember what the criteria are. There's undead, blood drinking, nocturnal. Yeah. Turning other people into vampires. So yeah, it's got it in spades.
Cool. Not
too much vampirism, maybe.
Too
where do you stand on the vampire zombie line?
Yeah. It's not quite Matheson, it's not I Am Legend, but yeah. Yeah. Which if you guys haven't read I Am Legend, we probably should.
Yeah, we really should at some point.
Mm. Do we have any other thoughts about Salem's Lot? Or One for the Road? You know, I know that Michael and Maddie probably haven't read it, but I read it a long time ago. I'm somewhat familiar with it.
I mean, I've not really got any thoughts. I just thought it was very nicely done.
Yeah.
It was a good ghost story with the possibility of being a vampire story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit,
I definitely suggest finding that one. It's in a couple of editions of Salem's Lot, but it's also floating around in Night Shift, I think. Something like that. So if you have a anthology of King hanging around, it might be in there. I think it's in Night Shift. Let me look. Stephen King, Night Shift. So, all right. Anything else that we want to talk about in terms of Salem's Lot, or shall we wrap this one up?
I think I'm happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yep.
Okay. Then I'll wrap this up and we can discuss what our next book will be. Hopefully not next year.
Exactly.
Oh,
it would be nice to do this slightly more frequently.
Hey, as I say in the closeout, we have aspirations of being monthly.
I have got a chat with Matt Robin. Do you know MR? What's their handle? I know they're Hodgie.
Hmm.
They're locked, but I don't know if you guys are on it. But they used to follow the Dracula Bites account.
Okay.
We did a recording about Dracula itself, and we're going to do the Icelandic Dracula, or as I like to call it, Fash Dracula.
Ah, so
we just extend that to you.
Powers of Darkness.
Yeah, Powers of Darkness, that's the one. But yeah, so that's about somewhere. And you've got one you've done, haven't you, Geoff?
I've got one that I've started on. I haven't actually recorded it yet. But yeah, looking at Fritz Lieber's Girl with the Hungry Eyes.
Oh.
Which is it's a vampire story, but it's also a marked criticism of marketing and commercialism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
And we've been meaning Suvani, haven't we?
We have been meaning Suvani, yes.
Like,
yeah. I know Varney will take forever. And
we'll do little blocks.
Yeah, we're
you know, moving, so yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think we will try and start doing that, yeah.
Yeah.
Been doing
have we wrapped this up or we
let's actually say we're wrapping up. So
yes.
Goodbye, everybody. We hope to see you within less than a year.
Yeah.
Hopefully next month. It's yes. May now. Yeah, let's shoot for the end of June.
That would be great.
And have a good one. Bye.
Goodbye.
Been listening to this Podcast Bites, an occasional podcast with aspirations of being monthly. Thanks. Your hosts are usually Alice Wilfred Earle, Maddie Tucker,
Michael Gordon, and me, Joffrey Sproul. If you're already a subscriber, we're thrilled to have you. Please tell your vampire-loving friends about us. If you aren't yet a subscriber, what are you waiting for? Just visit our website at thispodcastbites.com for more information. Also, please make sure to follow us on Twitter at Bites Podcast. This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 4.0 International License. Thanks again. We really do appreciate your support. Make sure to tip your waiters.